Hey, welcome to the film podcast. I'm really excited today, and I mean it this time. Usually I'm like, I kind of have to force my excitement. No, I'm always excited,
no,
but today I'm especially excited. We're doing something a little different today. First of all, I'll introduce myself and the people that are involved in this series. I am Ricardo, and with me is Brian Sauer.
Yes, indeed.
Say all your aliases so people know where you're from.
Rupert Pupkin is the big one. That's my blog, Rupert Pupkin Speaks. And I am Bob Freelander on Twitter. So those are the main aliases.
I like that. And then our second guest is Eric Peterson.
Hello, hello.
Skyping in from Michigan. Thank you. I know it's late out there. Thanks for doing that.
It's not too late. Don't worry about it. It's fine.
And you want to give any of your blogs and stuff like that?
You know, actually, my blog as of late has been, I used to write just full reviews and blog posts like most bloggers, but I've actually stolen a little bit from Brian there, and I've been doing, you know, things that are in my mind, and it'll be just like a short list of four or five things that I've been thinking about or into lately.
That's great, man.
Well, before we get into that, I do want to talk about that real quick, because I do like, I mean, we usually we used to be called the List Film Podcast, and we just changed to the Film Podcast because now we just talk about movies in general. But there's something really cool about like lists. I like you know, sometimes you're like, oh man, I just saw this sad movie. I wonder what like my top five favorite sad movies are, and then you just make a list, and you know that's kind of how the podcast came about. But I liked it a lot. I like right now Brian has a series. What is it? Underrated comedies.
Yeah, underrated comedies right now.
That's a good series.
It's been fun.
There's a lot of stuff. And also sometimes you're like, well, I think it's underrated, but then you get a bunch of people that are like, no, I love that movie.
Yeah, no, and with the internet, it becomes kind of a moot point as to what's underrated. I mean, there's the truly obscure, but even that is kind of up for question.
Yeah,
the internet's really about finding all those one-off people in all over the world that like the same thing you do. You know, you might not find anybody in your hometown or even in your state, but there's going to be four or five people around the world that are going to dig whatever.
Oh, yeah. They're going to dig inner space.
yes.
All right. So let's get to it. Today, we're talking. This is the first part of an ongoing series. We're going to probably be doing one a month, maybe, you know, two if we get a chance once the summer's over. But we're going to be talking about I don't know if we're going to do the entire catalog. We're going to try to do most of it. You know, we'll rotate some guests. You know, I know some of us will be like, oh, I'm tired of fucking Canon Film Group. but yeah, today we are talking about the Canon Film Group as they're known, or Canon Films. It's a production company. Eric, why don't you take it away and tell us a little bit about that?
All right. So Canon started in the late 60s, and it was just a small company that was making independent films and buying independent films. And kind of during the 70s heyday of the drive-in and the grindhouse theaters, they were selling movies to those venues. In the late 70s, they were – 1979 actually, they were bought by the Golan brothers, or – I'm sorry, they're cousins, Menheim Golan and Yoram Golobus. And they kind of transformed Canon into what we think of, which is 80s B pictures and especially action films. And a lot of their films had limited theatrical release, played the remaining drive-ins, but really became known for their being played on cable in the 80s and then populating the video stores. And a lot of their stuff was kind of, you know, lower grade B movie fare. A lot of action films, a lot of teen sex comedy type stuff, and you know, the ninja films most famously were part of their stable. But they brought like Chuck Norris to the fore, and you know, gave a lot of people a starting point. So
and some of them it was like their second win. I know with like Chuck Norris, I mean not Chuck Norris, with like Charles Bronson, he kind of brought him back into the limelight. I feel so.
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely.
So it's two brothers. Oh, man. I looked everywhere. I was like, I want to find the right pronunciation of this guy's name, man.
Oh. I've heard Menachem.
Yeah.
Something like that.
I think it depends on what part of the world you're standing in.
I've heard it in some commentary, and I cannot right now remember which one.
Like Menachem And then, but anyway, one was Menahem Golan, and then Globus. I had read that they were both they're both Globus, but Menahem changed his name to Golan. I'm not sure if that's I don't know if that's true or not. I it was one of the things I was researching. But anyway, it was the two cousins that came over, and I was raised on these movies. I mean, I'm an '80s kid, and these they were like kind of B movies, but man, did just going through this list, I realized, oh man, how many movies I've seen and like were kind of like important to me. Where
I think the common denominator in the vast majority of these films is they were fun.
Yeah, so going through this list, like just looking at all the films, I'm like, oh man, how much do I love American Ninja? Well, I mean, American Ninja 1, 2, and 4. But
so you're great with the sequels. I haven't seen, I mean, I was raised on them, but I haven't seen enough of the sequels, you know? I mean, obviously the Death Wish stuff, but, you know, American Ninja 3, 4, I don't think I've seen those.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I didn't see a lot of the sequels. I saw a lot of the early stuff, and that was about it.
Yeah, I was kind of, sadly, I watched all the Death Wish sequels.
I love the Death Wish sequels. I mean, take it all the way to 5, 6, I don't even know how many there were finally, but...
I think 5 altogether.
I think 5.
So yeah, so today we're going to be talking a little bit of you know, how they got started, which we did, and then we're going to also be talking about 4 specific films. I decided to pick the films where they, I guess they came in, in like 70, when did they buy it?
I believe it was 79 is 79. What I read.
Menahem had already been doing films in Israel, where they were born and then where they were from, and so he came to the States like already with the background of like filmmaking and writing, directing. So we're gonna start off with, I guess, I wanted to start here because it's one of the ones that I know the best, one of the films, meaning I've always. It's kind of one of those cult movies, and I figured we start with 1980s, The Apple, and then we do 4 films, just to start off, and then we'll see how that goes, and then, you know, in the next episode maybe we'll do 5 or 6, and
well, you know, I think these films, and they are The Apple, New Year's Evil, Enter the Ninja, and Death Wish 2. I think that they're also a good place to start because you have a weird, wacky musical kind of cash in. For a music trend, you've got a slasher flick, you have a martial arts movie, and you have an action film. And if you look through what Cannon did, that kind of sums up the vast majority of what they were successful at.
Oh, yeah, yeah. All we really needed was, like, we should have done The Last American Virgin, and that would have covered the spectrum of their range, basically. So, all right, so you guys want to get into it? First movie?
Sure.
All right. We'll talk about a film from 1980, The Apple. Now, this was actually directed by I feel like we're going to get, tweets. You're pronouncing it wrong. But we're going to call him Menahem, whatever. Menahem Golan. He helped with a screenplay, and he directed this. And you want to give us a little synopsis, Eric, on this movie?
Sure. The Apple from 1980. It's basically a biblical allegory using the powers of good and evil in the music industry. It's set up that's kind of supposed to be, I think, 1994, where there's this huge international pop song festival that's kind of like the Eurovision festival they have in Europe. And this guy, Mr. Bugalo, runs the BIM Corporation music company, and they're kind of the main entertainment company in the world at this point. And they, you know, they have a vested interest in their acts being at the top of the heap. So basically these two folk singers from nowhere Canada show up and kind of almost win the competition. And it's a really strange movie. It's very... in a lot of ways, it reminded me of Phantom of the Paradise.
Yeah, I was going to say, I wonder, you know, both Rocky Horror and Phantom of the Paradise, like, how much of an influence were they on him?
Yeah, it's a very, you know, making the deal with the devil. And like I said, it's a biblical allegory about you know, choosing good or evil, or easy or hard.
Yeah, no, and then the big, you know, the big corporation, very much like Death Records and in Phantom of the Paradise.
It's, yes,
there's a whole lot of parallels that are pretty hard to ignore.
And BIM was they keep using the word BIM, and it stands for Boogaloo International Music, right?
I believe.
Or yeah. So I rewatched all these films this last week. I don't know if you guys got a chance, but yeah.
I watched it recently. Yes.
It's so funny watching this film, how much like, just rewatching this, how much I hate American Idol. Like, I'm like, wait.
So before we go any further, I was going to ask you, you famously are not a fan of musicals.
Yes. Yeah.
Tell me what is about this film that works for you.
Oh, well, here it is. It's just the fact that like, he's a devil. Like, that's funny to me.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. I don't like musicals, but I definitely will be entertained if it's really good. You know what I mean? Like, so yeah. It's not like, oh, I'm going to hate all of them. No, I'm not a fan of that genre just because it takes me out of it when somebody just starts singing into the camera. But like, definitely like, I appreciate, you know, the good ones, you know, Singing in the Rain, all that stuff. But this is just so like cheesy and not serious at all. Well, I don't take it serious, so it's like, it's just a fun movie. And rewatching, I'm like, oh man. And the kind of the musical numbers are very 80s. And
yeah,
if you know my musical taste, I love the 80s. So it's just especially cheesy, and I do enjoy this one. This is one of the few that I do enjoy.
This has got to be one of the higher budgeted, at least whereas when the money shows up on screen,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
for canon across the board. And that's, to me personally, pretty fascinating when you see a movie done on this scale with no quote-unquote studio interference. I mean, they are their own moguls, basically, so they have control. And when you see a film made on this scale without any checks and balances, and I'm often fully against those checks and balances, mm-hmm. It produces something that is at least very memorable, I think, which this film is.
It's a very unique vision. And you were talking about musicals, and to me there's two basic types of musicals. You have the musicals where people break into song that's supposed to move the story. And then you have musicals that are about, like we were talking about Phantom of the Paradise, where the music makes sense because it's stage performances, because it's about musicians. And this might be the only musical I know of that mixes both of those.
Yeah, yeah.
Or one of the few. I'm sure there are others, but it's not – it's a mixture of those two styles.
Yeah, I mean, and you know what? Rewatching this, I was reminded of like how prophetic some parts of this movie were.
Oh, like, yes, most definitely.
Not only the whole like American Idol thing, which I'm glad to say I feel like I'm such a good American that I've never seen in a single episode of American Idol.
I can't believe I haven't either.
I haven't watched it either.
Congratulations, guys. We're better men for it, I feel. but one of the characters says, Mr. Boogaloo's like assistant says, this is his quote, "First you sell it, then you make it. That's marketing." And I'm like, wow, like how many movies are made that way nowadays?
How many movies are made that way before this?
Yeah. His motto is, let's come up with an idea of something crazy and we'll sell it and then we'll make it.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, and like Brian was saying, like, it's definitely one of the movies where you see the budget on screen, like just in the scene where they're kind of they're raiding the park where all like the hippies are, and all the guards, the policemen have like the BIM like logo, little triangle, and I'm like, wow, that's money. They definitely had to make that for this movie. That's crazy.
Well, this is also one of those films like Logan's Run or like I forget which one of the Planet of the Apes films where they used very modern architecture to represent the future. In Logan's Run, they're in a shopping mall, and in the Planet of the Apes movie, they're in Century City.
I think it was Escape.
Conquest. Well, this they filmed in Germany, and it looks quote unquote futuristic, but it was obviously some just brand new facility that had been built with these new architectural ideals. Yeah. And now, of course, that looks a little dated because it was, you know, 30 years ago, more than 30 years ago. But, you know, then it was, ooh, that looks really cool. And this is, you know, this is 1980. This is on the cusp of that.
Yeah, yeah. And this movie, I think, was made like in like 79, I think. And it took like a year. I think it had to do with like the music or something like that I heard. They had a tinker with. I'm sorry. I think it might have been made 78, and it took like 2 years.
I believe what I read said it was made in let's see here. Oh, September to December of 79 in West Berlin. Oh,
okay.
That tells you how old it was. There was a West Berlin.
And now it's funny because for some of these films, they would shoot in a lot of exotic locations that,
yeah,
you know, sometimes you're like, oh, wow, like, I can't believe they shot a film there. You wouldn't be able to do that nowadays.
Well, yeah, Canon was a very, like, international company in general.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Shooting all over the world.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that had to do with the cost, because
exactly.
I'm sure that, you know, when we get to Enter the Ninja, that was made in the Philippines, and the Philippines was very, very accessible to filmmakers. And I'm sure that there was some international money for them to film in Germany.
Yeah.
Or at least I wouldn't be surprised if there was.
Yeah, yeah. Where does Uwe Boll film at? Is it Germany now? Isn't it?
Well, he's German, and apparently his early films were financed by a tax loophole that's since been closed. But I'm thinking that he has enough of a fan base and enough of a market that he can get his films financed.
Man. Damn you, Apple. All right. Is there anything you guys want to say about the Apple?
Okay. So we talked about Phantom of the Paradise. The BIM symbol is basically the mark of the beast. If you look into certain biblical mythologies, the mark of the beast is supposed to be a three-sided triangle.
Yeah.
An equilateral triangle, I guess. And that's what the BIM symbol definitely is. The folk love song that at the beginning that kind of starts to get the attention of the crowd who have been watching this gaudy disco-esque rock opera is interesting in that it's one of those moments where the music is going from something big and overproduced back to something simple and basic and honest. And we keep seeing that throughout the history of music. You go and you look at something like the O Brother soundtrack, which was so popular because it was all about stripping away all the artifice and getting back to imperfect human, you know, somebody's emotion or, emotional honesty in the songs. Strangely, the youth of 1994 in this film were embracing rave/BIM music at the same time that this resurgence of folks looks like it's about to happen, which is kind of what happened around 94, because 94 is when you had Generation X getting into the rave culture, and at the same time there was a movement with at least within the alternative underground towards more rootsy rock, and this is also where you see what we consider alternative country now come to the fore. So that was kind of interesting that it does predict that trend to a certain degree.
I found that a lot, that how like I said earlier, like a lot of stuff applies to, you know, our culture nowadays.
Yeah. Let's see. Like Brian said, a lot of Rocky Horror elements.
Yeah.
So I originally saw this film because I'm a huge fan of one of the stars, Catherine Mary Stewart, who I've been a fan of her since the 80s. I've seen 90% of her films. She's just got this very likable, down-to-earth, girl-next-door kind of appeal. Mm-hmm. And my favorite, actually, musical number in the film is her song "Speed," which is ridiculous and over the top and kind of flat, but it works perfectly, I think, for its critique of the American go-go culture and the drug use to keep that going, which, of course, we all know only amped up in the 1980s.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's see. I had a note here that BIM strollers never caught on. There was a scene where they're pushing a triangle shaped stroller. Like, yeah, that's some production design there.
And Alfie, the guy who plays Alfie, this was his only credit. This is the only movie he ever made, right? And I don't know. I couldn't find anything else on him. I don't know. Maybe you found some stuff, but I don't know. Where did this guy end up? Like, he's like,
I have no idea.
I'm only going to come in, make one great musical, and then I'm out.
So Catherine Mary Stewart, she'd had a small role in a Crown International picture, and I think she was probably booked to do her next role, which I believe was in Nighthawk with Billy Dee Williams and Sylvester Stallone. She had just a real small cameo in that. So I think this probably didn't hurt her as much as it did other people, because this infamously was, and we'll talk about this, it's kind of a major flop.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Well, I mean, one thing that stands out in the movie is she's freaking adorable in the movie. And I mean, you even if you walk away hating the movie and all the characters in the movie, including her, you can't ignore the fact that she's just totally adorable.
Well, you know, I have a note here that said that she got a lot better looking as she got older.
I agree with that, but
she's adorable here.
Yeah, I just love she has like very straight hair in this movie, and something about that is just, I don't know, very appealing. I'm a huge fan too, Eric. I've seen most of her stuff. I'm a huge Night of the Comet fan.
Yeah,
I'm a huge fan of The Last Starfighter, obviously. But yeah, it was really neat to see her looking like she's so young and fresh faced here. Not that she looks any worse when she gets older; she looks great.
She's the lead in Night of the Comet, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Actually, by the way, total side note: Scott Weinberg was tweeting to Kelly Maroney the other night, and we all started like tweeting at her, and she was super nice and everything.
Oh wow!
So more Night of the Comet, and Kathryn Mary Stewart's on Twitter too, by the way.
Yeah, and she's awesome on Facebook, and she's really good about using it to tell people when the movie she's been in is played, and you know, doing a little interacting with the fans. And I've heard interviews with her in several other podcasts, and she comes off as being very down to earth and very personable and very understanding where she is professionally and appreciating what she has done in the past.
Yeah, she's got a great, in my experience too, seen a great appreciation for her fans. She's just one of those really genuine, nice people that is genuinely appreciative of all the love, as it were.
Oh yeah, definitely.
So I don't know if you know this. Just a random question. Do you know when like this started? Kind of like, was it in VHS that kind of it found its audience? Because I mean, it's a big cult film. Like I mean, well, at least around the circle that I hang out with, there was a guy who would not shut the fuck up about the Apple.
I feel like it got a big boost when it came out on DVD.
Was it?
Yeah, I think that's it.
As recently as, I think it was 2002-ish?
Yeah, yeah.
Something like that. That's when I first started hearing him. I'm sure a lot of people knew about it, obviously, well before that. Yeah. But for me, I felt like it started to really get a boost then, because I feel like either the VHS was out of print or something was weird where people hadn't quite seen it as much. And then when that happened, there was an explosion of fandom and screenings and all kinds of stuff, which is great.
Yeah, definitely. I think that along with the DVD, a lot of people that were programming midnight shows at local cinemas and who were in the cult film world started talking about it as well.
Yeah. And what I noticed with this movie, which was directed by Menahem, that like for being a B movie, a lot of B movies you watch, like the directors aren't good. Do you mean like shot wise, you know, setting up shots? But this and you know the next one on our that he directed on our list, Enter the Ninja, really well directed. Like just the shots, the composition of the shots. I'm like, wow, like given you know really good material, this guy you know would have made like an actual really really good movie.
Well, definitely, you know, there's talent there, that's for sure. There's an eye, there's an understanding about how things look on film. We were talking about Uwe Boll, who I recently watched one of his films, and I was like, this is so flat, because it's, I don't know, he just, there's no flair to his setups, and it's, I don't know, there's just something about it you look at and you go, well, that could be better.
Yeah. This guy definitely had a style, if that makes any sense. I was just talking about that with somebody. We were talking about Much Ado About Nothing. I don't know if you guys saw that.
Oh, I've not seen it yet.
No. Yeah, the Joss Whedon Shakespeare adaptation.
Yeah.
And I was talking to somebody about how it's his third film, and he still doesn't have like his own like signature style, like that you, when you watch something. I kind of miss that about like newer directors, you know?
Yeah.
Well, certain directors do have it. Like, you know, you watch Nicholas Winding Refn movie and you're like, oh, this definitely is this guy. Or you watch like, oh, even like simple dramas, you watch a Woody Allen film and you're like, this is Woody Allen. But you watch like Avengers or like Serenity and he still has like a TV feel, you know, like it feels like TV still.
For me, when it comes to Whedon, I think his spark and his talent is the writing. And, you know, and I think the same thing goes for Kevin Smith, whether you like him or not, that's where his real flair is in the writing. So that the fact that maybe he doesn't have the visual flair you know, that's all that different from somebody else is kind of overshadowed by the writing.
Yeah, yeah, and definitely watching, you know, Golan's films, you definitely I love his style. I'll say it. I like his directing style. So
I think the only issue I would take with him, and maybe more in Enter the Ninja when we get to it, is that I think he could use a better editor.
Yeah,
it's just my own.
Yeah, personal opinion. No.
I think almost everybody can use a better editor.
That's a fair point. I just was noticing in particular, not to get ahead of ourselves, but in Enter the Ninja, there were some shots where I'm like, okay, and cut it. Okay, yeah. No.
He's a lingerer.
A little bit, yeah. And that's fine. You know, some people are. I mean, certain people can linger in a great way, and I think we both know who I'm talking about.
Little man called Terrence Malick.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Well, he's one of the best. Let's just say lingerers. This about the Apple. The other thing about using up-tempo music is that can be very propulsive, and that can help drive the film itself. I mean, that can help set the film's rhythm in a way that something that's not as heavily infused with music has to find that rhythm in the directing and the editing.
Yeah. One of my favorite scenes is when the Alfie and BB go to the party right after, you know, the show.
Yeah.
And they're there, and you know, she's taken by one of the guys upstairs, you know? And she's like, oh, we're so high. And then you look at, she's in the second floor, first of all. But then, like, she's there with Alfie, who's her boyfriend and stuff, and like literally like 10 minutes into this thing, like she's making out with this dude, and I'm like, oh, what's going on here?
Well, I mean, I think they're trying to set up this like fantasy world and whatnot, but yeah, I mean, it is a little bit questionable, but I don't know, if it was up to me, I'd find almost every character in this movie pretty annoying, and I'd want to get the hell out of there in any context. But at the same time, I feel like he does set up this crazy fantasy world in a really interesting way that I believe it, you know. Once I'm in it, I believe it somewhat.
Yeah, and also in hindsight, it's really about the seductive power of fame and riches, you know, and whether or not you're going to trade your artistic vision for those things.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And definitely, like, they beat the biblical allegory. They beat you with it. Like,
I mean, from the title on down. I know. But yeah, no, you're right. You're right.
But yeah, you know, in the end, when God shows up in the Cadillac.
can I just say really quickly that I have and this is my personal issue, I despise hippies. I hate hippies. I, on a regular basis, say, once upon a time, a cop could hit a hippie in the head with a stick, and everyone knew the cop was in the right. And my experience has been that, yeah, most of the time I would love a cop to come up and hit a hippie in the head with a stick. So the idea that God's going to come down and side with the hippies kind of just, you know, it's like nails on the chalkboard to me. But in this, I guess it kind of works.
Yeah, I'm with you on the whole hippie thing.
I am too, but I got to say, I think hippies are much maligned, partially because of the way that they've been portrayed in cinema.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, terribly awful and annoying hippies in real life. I've met those too, but I'm just saying.
I know what you're saying, and like I said, it's my issue, and I grew up in a town that was run by hippies, and it was so – anyway, I mean, that's a whole other thing.
Sure.
You know, and the other thing is, you know, I'm a punk rocker, so we're supposed to hate hippies. So, I mean, there's that as well. Yeah, there's
a natural arch nemesis there. That makes
exactly,
sense.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right, so what would you guys rate this? And we're going to use the old Letterboxd rating system, which is 1 to 5 stars. You can use half stars. So why don't we start with Brian? What do you rate this film?
I, you know, this is one where I've seen it a few times now, and I can be kind of a fickle viewer sometimes. So when I returned to it this time, I was just, I guess, maybe not in the right frame of mind. And like I said, I found every single character, except for Catherine Mary Stewart, to be obnoxious, annoying, shrill. And so I had a little more trouble with it than I usually do. I still love the whole, like I said, the world that's created.
So, how many stars would you give it?
I'd say 2.5 out of 5 for me.
2.5 out of 5.
That's me. But I mean, that's not a particularly, I mean, that's not to say people shouldn't seek it out anyway.
Yeah.
That's just my personal enjoyment this time around. It's a very memorable film. Let's leave my review at that.
Well, with the things with these films is that they can be bad movies that you still like. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
They have a really low rating, but you're like, I still love it for certain reasons, so. Eric, what do you rate this film?
I'm going to give it 3 stars, and like Brian, I've had different experiences with this film. The first time I saw it, I enjoyed it. The second time, I was kind of, and in the most recent viewing, I was like, yeah, this is enjoyable. So I give it 3, and I definitely recommend it. And I also definitely recommend watching it in a group with, you know, the appropriate beverages or whatever.
Yeah.
Just having a good time with it. I mean, this isn't something you're going to sit down and you're going to be like, oh, that tracking shot's amazing. But
yeah.
No, that's actually almost essential, because I watched it by myself. You know, I didn't even put it on. Like, sometimes I'll watch a movie like this with my wife, and we'll both get a big kick out of it. But yeah. It really did have an impact that I watched it by myself. You need to watch it with other people. It's essential.
Yeah, it's going to be summer here in LA, and there's a lot of outdoor movie film venues where you go see, like, it's kind of like a drive-in, but it's like you take your wine, blanket.
Picnicking,
yeah. And I'm kind of against those at certain points. Like, you don't want to watch North by Northwest there, because I want it on film, and I want and I want the sound, and you know, I want all that stuff, and you can't get that with, you know, when somebody's projecting a Blu-ray onto a wall. So, but this is one of the films where I'd be like, yeah, like, you want that. Yeah. You want to be a little drunk, you know, and maybe get a little live singing going on.
You know? Well, this is definitely a midnight movie.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Big time. Yeah. And my rating would be, even though it's really fun and, you know, it does beat you over the head with the whole biblical thing, and it is a musical, at the end of the day, I give it 1.5 stars. But
really,
again, I still recommend it. Like, hey, go see it. It's a fun movie, like you said. With a couple of beers in you, you're definitely going to have fun. All right, we'll take a break, and we'll come back discussing the next film on our list, New Year's Evil. But we'll leave you with an excerpt from an interview with Menahem Golan.
Canon, once it became powerful, and I mean powerful, it can dictate the selling of a movie to a distributor. That is the power that we have in foreign markets. We came to America to make American movies that could be sold to independent distributors around the world. Let me start really from the beginning. The beginning is that I was raised as a kid on American motion pictures. I was educated. I was Americanized by the cinema, by the American cinema. I lived in a little town called Tiberias. They came, we had a cinema. I was in this cinema every Saturday night. It was like a bread and butter for me. It was a rule. There was no Saturday night that I was not in the cinema. And then on a Wednesday afternoon when we had the matinee, I was there. And of course, if a movie even didn't reach the Saturday night and it came on a Tuesday, I was there. And it was in 99% of the cases, it could not have been but an American movie. Why? The major company system with the stars of Hollywood, with the feeling that they are giving to the people of the world another kind of life, to get them out of their dreary life that the century gave us. The cinema was practically controlled by those major companies. And I was educated through my youth, like any other kid, in millions of little towns, in millions of little cinemas, by living the American life. And when we came to America, we said to ourselves, that's the way that we can build our place in the cinema of the world, which means make an American movie with production values, with a good story, with, call it, star system, be involved with the quality film creators of America, and bring it to the world, not via the major companies. Create your own system, sell it to the independent. And all of a sudden, when we came to Cannes, you saw a line of distributors getting a number, like in a barber shop, to meet Yoram and me. We became popular there because we brought to them what they could never get. They could never get a good commercial American film to compete for a Saturday night date in their own country. Once we had that power, we could have, you know, be swallowed by Hollywood and became like anybody else. But what we tried to watch, we didn't want that. We brought Europe with us to Hollywood. Creativity, a feeling of doing something better. And then when Taiwan wanted to buy our Death Wish 3 or Death Wish 2 or The First Ninja, you know, or a kind of an action picture coming from Hollywood, a country like Taiwan or a country like the Philippines, etc., we say to the local distributor, sorry man, you have to take John Cassavetes first or you don't get Charles Bronson. And we started to sell tomatoes with, you know, cucumbers as well as peaches. You know, we sold them in packages, and we forced the first Cassavetes screening in Taiwan. Never before, live streams. Never, Cassavetes could not get a screen. He could not even be talked about in that country because all you saw in the cinema there was martial art movies. So how can you expect kids in Taiwan to see a little more intelligent film, something better, something with more aspirations, you know, intellectual? But they do have universities, they do have students, they do have people. You do have people who are studying and are eager to see something better, something new. Except that those new films could not get to their cinemas. The distributors were scared, so we forced it. We gave it practically for nothing, and now you know that in Taiwan they have to see an Altman movie. They have to see Zeffirelli. They will see an opera Otello, because otherwise they are not going to get Charlie Bronson.
All right, and we're back, and we're going to jump into the next film, which is again from 1980, New Year's Evil. Eric, take it away. Tell us a little bit about it.
So New Year's Evil is a slasher flick that is set in Los Angeles, and it's, as the name would suggest, New Year's Eve, and a famous punk rock singer apparently is hosting some kind of MTV-esque countdown to the New Year. And she starts getting phone calls from this killer who claims he's going to kill naughty girls at the strike of midnight in each time zone across the country, with her being the last victim. And it's kind of a race to see if she's going to survive and to figure out who the killer is.
Yeah. So it's basically the New Year's Eve, you know, with Dick Clark, but yeah, with a punk spin to it.
And punk then, slash metal, something yeah, in there. Yeah. Yeah.
And this is right up your alley because you love the punk, so.
Yes, I do.
All right. So it came out in 1980, and this wasn't directed by Menachem Golan. I'm going to just call him Golan from now on because it's too hard to.
That's fine.
This was directed by Emmett Alston, who didn't direct that many films. He did like 7 movies. And he took like long, he did one, he did a couple in the 80s, and then he took a long break, and then he did one in the 90s, and a total of 7, so.
2 things of note, real quick. He directed Demon Warp.
Oh, yeah.
Which is amazing.
1988.
Totally what the fuck crazy movie. I highly recommend people check out.
Yeah.
And he wrote Hunter's Blood, which is a sort of a cheapy knockoff of Deliverance, which is really good.
I have not seen that. Any cool like actors that people would know? In that?
Oh, in Hunter's Blood, yeah. The biggest one is Clu Gulager.
Oh, okay.
He's great. And they've run it at the New Beverly a few times, and since he's here in L.A., and since he's a regular at the New Beverly, I think he's done a little impromptu Q&A.
Oh, wow. Occasion.
Very cool. Very nice. Cool.
All right, so New Year's Evil. Man, I was hard to get to this movie a little bit for me.
It's a little tough.
Yeah.
I was actually kind of taken by surprise by this film because I was figuring out it was going to be just another slasher, but there was something about it that I really liked. The look of it I thought was really good. It had I had asked Ricardo to read an article about giallos. Did you get a chance to look at that?
I did.
I was totally thinking, not having known about the article, but it definitely feels like it's either influenced by or
definitely.
Probably. Yeah, I mean, it has much more of a giallo feel than a traditional American slasher feel.
So for those who don't know, giallos were Italian crime films, largely of the 70s, that were murder mysteries that often didn't make a lot of sense but had a lot of style. They were very artistic, and they had tropes like there was usually a knife used in the killing, and the killer usually wore black gloves, and you saw a lot from the killer's point of view. And it's thought that they were very influential on especially Halloween and other slashers in the 1980s. So I thought this had a nice giallo-esque feel to it, especially with the look of the film and a lot of the locations, and the seeing the streets of Los Angeles circa like 1980.
That's actually something I always like is LA-based films circa 19 late 70s. Actually, anytime to be honest, really.
I'm with you.
Any LA film, anytime. But yeah, definitely this period is pretty interesting, especially when they're calling out street names and everything.
Yeah.
Like he says exactly where he is, whether or not they're actually shooting there, who knows? But
well, and also a lot of this appeared to be shot not on the streets you usually see. So not in front of a lot of the famous landmarks, but kind of more of the outer ring residential areas and, you know, shopping areas and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I don't know if they deliberately avoided landmarks, but I don't remember seeing almost a one.
Yeah, but you know what? Like, being born and raised here in L.A., like, this and Death Wish 2, it'd be like, oh, I know exactly where that street is at.
Yeah, yeah. I had a little bit of that, too.
It's really, like, but streets you don't see, like, you know, in mainstream film, because they're not major streets and stuff. But
I think I've mentioned this before on the show, but my wife and I, she's from the Valley originally, mm-hmm. and so whenever we watch an L.A.-based movie, it's always like, what street are they on? Where are they? It's just fun to play.
Yeah,
it's just a fun game.
Yeah. So the things that I like from New Year's Evil, definitely the look of it was cool, and after reading the article, and I actually seen a couple of those films that you were talking about.
Yeah.
I totally got what you're talking about, which, because I rewatched it again, surprisingly. Okay. After the first time, I had a hard time watching it. I read the article, and I'm like, oh, yeah, totally. And I just kind of skimmed through it and for the second time. And definitely the look of it, the POV stuff, I dig.
Mm-hmm.
And the music, the score is really, at first, especially the first, the opening, like, theme music, it had like a little like Warriors feel to it. And I'm like, oh, yeah. I had to double check to see if it was the same composer, but it wasn't.
Well, that was one of the other things about the Giallos. A lot of them had the band Goblin or bands like Goblin, these 70s prog European bands that were doing different, like, how do you describe that? Like proggy synth music?
Yeah, I'd say,
That was accessible and fun for the style.
Yeah.
And that meshed well with the artistic look. And this, you know, with the exception of a few performance pieces, had that same kind of score going on.
Yeah, yeah. And if you, I don't really recommend this, but if you just want to, like, skim through it to see what this is like before you rent it, you could just go over YouTube. It's there in its entirety.
Yeah, I watched the whole thing on YouTube one afternoon.
It was on Netflix Instant. Did they pull it down with that big group of MGM?
They pulled it down. I looked for it. I looked for all these four, and so the Apple is streaming on Netflix right now, so you could check that out. But the other three are not. But you could find them on Vudu or Amazon Instant. All three of these are. So,
cool. Death Wish 2 is on Blu-ray.
Yeah,
just recently.
Yeah. And all right, so Eric, do you have anything?
Yeah, I've just got a couple of notes. So just, you know, obviously one of the things with these films is also the fashions and the styles and the trends of the time. You start to see what people thought was the height of fashion, and you look at it now and sometimes you shake your head. That's always fun. You see the cars and the clothes and the shoes. Kids cruising in their cars. You know, it's funny because this was a trope of films from probably the early 60s, late 50s until, I don't know, maybe the 80s. But it seems like that teenage car culture has started to fade from at least from America in a lot of places. I'm sure there's still a lot of places where it exists, but you don't see it quite as much. But there was definitely some of that in this film. Go ahead.
Speaking of cruising, that's one of the things that I was like, oh my god, like, I totally forgot about cruising. I kind of caught the tail end of it here in LA, especially because mm-hmm. they had a like resurgence of cruising because of the fact that import cars became really like big in like the like early excuse me, like mid to late 90s, especially like after like the Fast and the Furious came out.
Mm-hmm.
There was like everybody had a Honda that had a really loud muffler, and there was a lot of cruising, especially in certain suburbs. So a lot of times when you drive down LA, you'll see a lot of signs that they never took down that say no cruising. So, and they're not talking about the
William Friedkin kind.
Yeah, they're not talking about that movie.
You can watch the Friedkin film in those areas. I think.
So the next thing I have is Blaze, who is the punk rock / metal singer. She's a little old to be.
Yeah.
You know, she's a very attractive woman. Let's put that out there. She's attractive, but she's a little old to be this kind of icon. You know, she's.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out what her history was. Was she a former rocker herself?
Yeah. So let's say that you know, she's got a son who's in his early 20s. That's revealed fairly early on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so. You got to think, let's say that she She had him when she was 18. You know, so that means that she probably was starting her music career in the mid-60s. And as we discussed before, hippies and punks don't necessarily mix. And all, yeah. A lot of hippies did not cross over into punk rock, but hey, whatever.
Well, you know, they I guess one thing they do give a sense of it, and maybe like this is interesting now that you mentioned the hippie thing, is she's talking at the beginning about press releases and sort of quote-unquote marketing speak.
Yeah.
And she says, I want to see those press releases before they go out. She's clearly somebody who's sort of been, I don't want to say corrupted by, but certainly gotten caught up in the whole idea of this whatever.
The industry, yeah.
Yeah, the industry. So you could say maybe, just as total speculation, but like former hippie turned corporate slash...
Well, isn't that what the hippies did? Sold out.
Anyway. Yeah, no, you're right. And that's what I think maybe they're trying to portray here. I think we're extrapolating probably more than most people do from this movie. But it's just that you mentioned that. I was like, wow, okay, maybe that's where it comes from. Maybe that's where she was originally.
So there's a scene where punks are slam dancing very slowly. Yeah, you don't slam dance slowly. It doesn't happen. The killer keeps calling her while with recordings or while he's doing the kills, and you just look at it and you're like, there's no cell phones. I mean, you got to find a payphone or a landline somewhere to do that.
When he's got to record the killings when he does it, yes. And play back the recording into the payphone. And
and then they're trying to trace the phone call, and you're like, whoa, remember when that was a thing?
Yeah. That's always entertaining to me. I kind of miss that in some ways. Like, yes. Obviously, it's been said to death, but cell phones kind of kill movies a little bit just for.
I have an acquaintance who writes mysteries, and I was at one of her events, and she was talking about how cell phones have killed the suspense novel because everyone's like, well, why don't they just call the cops on the cell phone?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have to come up with things like there's no service or the phone's dead.
Yeah.
I have a note here that says disco rears its ugly head. definitely there's some disco in there. There's some new age talk, the I'm okay, you're okay-esque kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the end of the 70s going into the 80s.
That we definitely had that book in our house.
sex, drugs, rock and roll, the usual thing. What else? Oh, the killer dresses up as a bunch of different things, you know, like different professions.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to go into all of them, but I just have a note of Disco Man as one of them.
That's the mustached guy. Yeah.
That's my favorite. I think
I like that they show him like grooming the mustache before he puts it on.
Oh yeah,
there's some care taken for that.
Well, the thing is, if you're gonna go out killing with a thick mustache, you want it to look normal. You don't want to stand out.
Yeah, no, you gotta make people buy it.
Yeah, like sense. Someone's gonna be like, "What's wrong with this guy? This guy has a weird mustache. He must be going up for killing."
That's the first sign to me.
Yeah. Every time I look at somebody with a disheveled mustache, I'm like, "This guy's up to no good."
They just think of Joe Spinell right away.
Yeah.
So I also have a note here that there's a scene at a drive-in where people are watching an old horror film. And it kind of, to me, is the juxtaposing the old-style horror film with this is the new-style horror film.
Yeah.
And the old-style horror film was much more supernatural or, you know, vampires or monsters, whereas, you know, this was the arrival of the horror film involving a human or fairly human killer, at least in the early days of the slasher film.
Yeah. And you know what I noticed a common thread throughout these movies, now that you bring it up, Brian, is mustaches.
Oh, my God.
Mr. Boogaloo has a sweet mustache.
Yep, yep. Yes.
The killer in this one, the mask. Enter the Ninja, Franco Nero has an amazing mustache.
Yeah, he's personified.
Yeah, a nice blonde mustache.
Mm-hmm.
And then Death Wish, Bronson has a mustache. Guy. Yeah, so...
So the last note I have is dummy off the building, which is always one of my favorite.
Yeah,
you can always tell.
The limbs?
Yeah, I was going to say the way the arms flop or go one way.
Yeah. And then, like, you see the wide of the dummy going down the building.
Yeah.
But then when you see the shot of the killer on the floor, like, it's, like, perfectly, like, kind of, like, bent. Like, you're like, look. It would be a lot of splatter. Yeah.
One thing I'll say about this movie is that the killer and his... Well, okay, we won't give that away, but there's a mask that's worn in the movie that's particularly creepy.
Yeah.
And that's one thing I miss a lot about 80s horror films is they... And just in general, 80s movies wherein masks were brought out, but definitely horror films. I'm thinking of like Terror Train and some other stuff. There are some creepy fucking masks, and they just don't make creepy masks like that anymore.
Even like for Halloween, like you go to a Halloween shop and
it's all plastic stuff, but those big rubber masks you put on over your head that are just even more I don't know. This particular mask is creepy as fuck.
Yeah.
And I wish somebody had taken it and used it in another better movie. That's my take.
Yeah. Or released it for sale for Halloween.
I'm surprised there isn't like a site dedicated to masks.
To film masks.
Film masks, exactly. Like a New Year's Evil mask, the Terror Train mask, you know, the Halloween 3 masks. I know you can get those, but
yeah.
Anyway.
Halloween film masks, trademark pending.
Yeah, there you go. The one thing that irks me about this a little bit is that the killer is played by an actor named Kip Niven.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he's a guy that if you see him, he's hugely familiar to you if you were of like our age where you watched a lot of TV in the late 70s, early 80s. He's in tons of television, but he's also in a ton of movies. But to me, he looks like a very slightly like Bruce Jenner, like an evil Weasley Jenner.
Yeah.
And there's something just very disquieting, disturbing about that.
Oh my God. I never put that.
That's what I kept seeing in my head. I'm just
totally.
Like,
the Decathlon murders.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he's a bit over the top, and he's not usually, and maybe for good reason, given this larger role in a movie. Mm-hmm. But as a background player, he's fantastic. And I always love to see him show up in movies.
And the director must have been, he kept telling like Kip, like, creepy, you have to make your eyes big, dude. You can't keep... Because all his scenes, like, he would either not blink or just have, like, his eyes were, like, wide open. Like, they couldn't get any wider.
No, he's effective in this. I'll give him that. He's definitely memorable and scary and turns on a dime in this certain way.
Yeah.
He can be very charismatic and then turn and just completely become scary in just a minute's notice.
Well, yeah. You know, that's another thing of the era. We're coming out of the when this is made, coming out of the first era of serial killers being publicized much more than they had in the past, and maybe even there weren't as many. And a lot of them were described as being very kind of charming and you know, I mean, people being able to change their personas quickly.
Yeah, that's what the one thing you always hear about Ted Bundy, charismatic as hell.
Yeah. And this film actually is the first film of this series. And we're going to see this actress in a couple other films from the Canon production. Louisa Moritz, she plays Sally. She's in like this. She's in like The Last American Virgin. She's in a couple other ones produced by these guys. So I don't know if one of the Golan brothers was maybe going out with her. We don't know. All right. Is that it? Should we move on to the next film?
Sure. We should go ahead and grade it.
All right, so Brian, what do you grade it?
Not to sound like a broken record, but I go 2.5 on this one again. There are definitely some enjoyable things worth checking out. You should probably see The Apple before you see this movie.
Yeah,
I know I gave him the same grade, but it's for varying reasons. I'm a big fan of slashers, so that holds a little bit of weight with me. But definitely see The Apple before you see this.
Eric,
I'm going to give it 2.5 as well. I think. You know, there's a lot to like in it. I think it is a little bit flabby. I think it could have been tightened up a little bit. And it, you know, it's definitely worth a look. And you know, this one took me by surprise. I was like, okay, a slasher, and I was like, wow, this is actually kind of entertaining. So
yeah, and as you say, it's more giallo-like than traditional slasher. So for that, I think it's somewhat interesting.
It's a nice transitional film between those two periods.
Yeah,
and I will go with 2. Because it was a little hard to watch, but again, like style was pretty good. The music, that like weird synth music, I dug, and so I'm gonna go with 2. But it was fun. I would definitely recommend The Apple before this one. And within these 4 films, I go Apple over New Year's Evil. So there you go. All right, and now we'll jump into the next film. We won't take a break.
Okay.
Enter the Ninja from 1981. Right on. All right. Directed again by Menachem Golan. Damn that name. And we have much more films to cover with his name on it. All right. So this stars Franco Nero. Why don't you tell us about it, Eric?
All right. So, I'm just going to be blunt. You seen Chain? The idea of, so Franco Nero is a ninja. He graduates from ninja school. He's got a rival at school. He goes off to see his war buddy in the Philippines. His buddy's being hassled by some local power brokers who want his land, and he has to come to his rescue. It's basically Shane. You know, ninja stuff ensues from there.
Yeah, yeah. And this film, it stars... so this is part one of a trilogy that they have nothing to do with each other. It's this Enter the Ninja, which is this one. Then Revenge of the Ninja is part two.
Which is badass.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And then Ninja 3, the Domination?
Domination.
Yes.
Which is actually out on Blu-ray tomorrow.
Yes.
Well, Tuesday, which will be Tuesday the 11th of June.
Yeah. This podcast will be out by then. So this one, I'd say we're going to cover it later on, Ninja 3, the Domination, but do yourself a favor. Go out and get the Blu-ray now.
Yes, yes.
It's
pretty cheap.
Yeah, yeah. Do yourself that favor. You'll definitely thank us when we get to Ninja 3. And you'll be in cahoots with us. all right. Enter the Ninja. I have a lot to say about this. This was like their first...
Go ahead.
I love ninjas, first of all.
Well, I was going to say, like, a big thing, and you probably had this. We all probably had this. Ninja fever. There was a veritable ninja fever. Yeah. And when I was in high school, I grew up in the Midwest, but I'll be damned if ninja stuff wasn't just everywhere. And if there wasn't some kid getting a weapons catalog confiscated by a teacher every other week, trying to buy throwing stars. Or,
there's an infamous story in my town about a – they used to have a local army surplus store that used to sell throwing stars.
Yes, we had that too.
A martial arts supply place as well, and one kid went and bought – them and his mother threw a fit and it became this big stink, and suddenly you had to be 18 to even look at him almost.
I had ninja fever. I got it really bad, guys. Yeah. That definitely, like, so my the first movie that got me into ninja films was American Ninja, which we'll talk about in a later episode.
Okay.
Also produced by the Cannon Film Group. But after I saw that movie, I went out and tried to rent every single movie. I'm like, give me any movie with the title Ninja. If it ends with Ninja, starts with Ninja, give it to me. I want it. And eventually, they gave me Enter the Ninja. And again, I rewatched this, and it's a fun movie. I had a lot of fun. Especially, I like the movies. So, The Apple and New Year's Evil, traditional, you know. Regular, you're hearing people's voices. This dubbed,
and very obviously,
yeah. And
international cast,
you got to do it. It's just funny because I think genre fans know Franco Nero's voice, and you know, he sounds nothing like this guy, so it's but you know, somebody else not being familiar with him wouldn't throw them at all, probably.
Yeah,
and we should mention what Franco Nero is probably most famous for internationally is playing Django, the original Django.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And if you saw Django Unchained, the Tarantino movie, he's the guy at the bar that asks Jamie Foxx what his name is.
Yeah, and that's why that joke is so
funny. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, he looks great. Like, I mean, in that movie, he looks still like, man, I want to see him in more movies now. Like, I'm like, where have you been? Enter the Ninja. And the only cast member that I guess he's in all three movies, the Revenge of the Ninja and Ninja 3, is, I'm going to butcher his name, but I'm known for that, so I'm allowed to butcher people's names. Kazugi.
Close enough.
What is it? How do you say it, Eric?
I think it's Kazugi. I think it's Kazugi.
All right.
I don't know. I should know better. I actually have.
It's almost like
Japanese
people usually
family members, but
they usually say it as one word, basically.
Yeah,
Sho Kasugi.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just like that.
We'll call him Sho. And Sho, you've seen him if you've seen any like martial arts movies of the 80s, you've probably seen him. He starred in one of like Van Damme's early movies, The Eagle and the what is it? The Eagle and something else. He's in Revenge of the Ninja, and he's in Ninja 3, and great. And not only is he a great villain in this, but he's also he plays a really good guy. You care for him, like Revenge of the Ninja and stuff.
Well, he became a one man industry for these films in the 80s.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And so this movie, I like the fact that it is dubbed because it gives it like kind of like a spaghetti western feel to it. It feels like a little bit like a has has a slight like Sergio Leone feel to it because the voices are so American. And if you know Franco, it sounds nothing like that. But
yeah.
It definitely lends like an extra layer of cool. I like that. I find it cool. I like there's a lot of funny stuff throughout this whole movie that is just funny and fun. The fact that when he first meets what's her name? Marianne.
Yeah. Susan George, yeah. She's great. I love Susan.
She's like trying to attack him, but like he holds her down. But I never notices he's kind of groping her boob, like for a good like 5 seconds, and I'm like, whoa, what happened? Like they couldn't find another take where he's not groping her boob.
Maybe he did that in every take.
Yeah, I'm sure he did. That's his move. But yeah, this again. So I guess the 70s had kung fu.
Yep.
You know, with all the Bruce Lee movies and, you know, that was catching on. Before that, I think it was karate, right? That kind of was late 60s, early 70s. So it was karate, kung fu, and then 80s brought...
Or judo, I guess.
Judo, 60, yeah.
Yeah.
And brought the ninja. And that's why this movie's entitled Enter the Ninja, because they were trying to capitalize on Enter the Dragon. So...
Yeah. I'm kind of curious. I don't know the answer to this, but what was the first big... ninja film was maybe it was this.
I knew that fact, and I don't know. I have so many notes that I don't know where that's at. But yeah, no, this was like the second big ninja film. There had been one more in like late 70s. I want to say 78. There was one more. I can't remember the title of it, but this was actually the second big ninja film.
Okay,
but this really started kind of like Cannon's, you know, foray into just everything ninja, you know, American Ninja 1. And I don't know if you guys caught this, but at the very end, when he's fighting in the when he's going through that warehouse slash like a ring, he's making his way in, just killing a bunch of henchmen. One of the henchmen is a really young Michael Dudikoff.
Oh my god, I totally didn't catch that.
And did not notice that.
And he's really like he's chubby. He's not as thin as he is in American Ninja. And he's got long hair. And I'm like, "Oh my god, and it's so funny because eventually he went on to star in American Ninja." So, it's yeah, a little cameo by Michael Dudikoff.
That's cool.
But all right. Eric, Brian, yes. Anything you want to say about this movie?
What did I have about this movie? This is my least favorite. God, I sound like such a hater tonight, but this is my least favorite of the three films. But I guess I feel like it's a little bit stodgy. Like I said, some of that editing stuff slows it down a little bit for me. The fight scenes are pretty good. Nero's not necessarily, you know, he's no Bruce Lee. We'll put it like that. But you know, he works, and the story is like sort of that archetypal story that you've seen before. So that makes it a little less interesting. One thing that is a highlight for me is Christopher George, only because he's often very grumpy in movies, but he's not typically an out and out villain in a lot of the stuff I've seen, and he's just like a nearly mustache twirling a villain in this one. I like him. He's got like a great gravelly voice, and he's just one of those actors that I don't know. He's just one of those 70s actors that I always like to see pop up in something. So he's a highlight, and I love Susan George. I'm a big fan of hers across the board. Just recently rewatched Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry, which she's awesome in, and so I always kind of like to see, and obviously Straw Dogs. So I always like to see her in the movie. The cast is really the highlight for me, I think. I think I was entertained by the guy who plays the hook. He's not particularly effective as a villain. He's a very sort of small man who looks like a sort of a Charles Laughton knockoff.
Yeah. But like an Irish.
Yeah, he's definitely either, I mean, I don't know if the guy cashed in on the way that, or if he's deliberately trying to fashion himself a Charles Laughton-y type with a hook for a hand, but he's not particularly threatening as a villain, and he gets, it's, I don't know. But there's some good violence in this, especially that last fight scene, which there's some good, There's some decapitations and things throughout the film, and it's fun in that way. The gore and it's just the beginning. I feel like they did exactly what you're supposed to do in a sequel with revenge, which is they made it that much gorier, more action, and just yeah, like I said, just brought it up a notch. So this is the beginnings of that, and I like the cast and everything, but I prefer the second two.
Yeah, and a little trivia on this film. It was originally supposed to be directed by the director of New Year's Evil, Emmett Alston, but then so he was going to direct Enter the Ninja, and Golan was going to direct Death Wish 2, but then Charles Bronson was like, "No, I want the original director of Death Wish 1, Michael Winner, to come back and do 2," and so he kind of took over directing Enter the Ninja. So that's a little background on that.
Interesting.
Yeah, and. I got my notes. Here we go. The first ninja movie was The Octagon with Chuck Norris.
Oh, okay. That's a good movie.
Which just came like, I want to say late 79 or like 80. And so that was the first one. And then this one was which was the second big ninja film.
I think
so.
Octagon's on Netflix right now, actually.
Really?
I'm going to look right now.
If it is, I'm going to put it in my instant queue. All right. So, Eric, what do you have on this film?
So, I like the opening, which is Franco Nero graduating from ninja school. They do this final test hunt that's got a lot of great ninja action.
That's a really interesting hunt because it's like, it's almost like he does kill some people. Doesn't he?
Maybe we don't.
That's what's confusing because he seems to kill people in this "quote unquote" sparring, exercise.
But then when like all the guys he kills are at the end, they're there for the ceremony, and like one of them has like a piece of like wood.
No, you're right. I guess they do kind of make it. You're right. They do make it pretty clear now.
I liked about it is it had a certain energy. It just kind of throws you in there. You don't know what's going on, but it's got this energy to it that unfortunately I think dissipates once you get. Past the credit sequence, which is the other thing I really liked.
Oh yeah, I was going to say that's in my notes too. That just man doing martial arts in a black background, white credits.
I think it's all the different weapons, so you get like a demonstration. And from there, it he goes and he visits his war buddy, and it turns into a Western. And I thought it was kind of flabby. It could have been tighter. I think it lost that energy of that initial scene. I did like. Susan George, and I did like some of that stuff. And I didn't mind that it was kind of cartoony in a lot of spots either. I mean, that was kind of fun. Overall, I do think it's the weakest of the three ninja films. But some great crazy action. And, there's the bad guys going at their own ninja to come in and fight on their side. So like I said, it's like a Western.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And, this was Cho's first film. This was like his introduction to. This was his first American film. Sorry, but this kind of he like you said he kind of pushed this ninja movement in film, and a couple of things I noticed was, what's her name?
Susan George.
Susan George. She goes out because she hears something. And Cho traps her. Like, he he's got her in his, like, death grip. But she manages to get away and punch him in the face. It's like, for a ninja master, that's kind of, I don't think that should be happening.
Yeah, it's a little embarrassing.
Yeah.
So I got two other notes that are kind of movie references. One is that there's a scene at the kitchen table that's a reference to Citizen Kane.
Oh, did they do the breakfast thing? I totally missed that. Wow.
And the other is they go to Japan to get their ninja. And they go to this theatrical agent who starts talking about all these actors that he can get for them.
That is a pretty good bit.
And he references having worked with Robert Mitchum, which Robert Mitchum in the 70s made a film called Yakuza,
which is great,
in Japan with Paul Schrader. That's a really good film.
Yeah, I like that movie.
And I took that as a reference to that.
Yeah, no, that's a great movie. Sydney Pollack film.
Yeah. I
thought it was Paul Schrader for some reason.
Paul Schrader and his brother wrote it.
Okay, yes.
Sydney Pollack directed. Yeah. It's great. It's got
a really good film.
Yeah, I really like it.
That's
good,
one of the
good ending. Really good ending.
That's one of the ones where, in a week, like in a weird like twisted fantasy, I want that movie to be like one. I want that movie to be remade.
Yeah, I could see that. Could be interesting. I think that one's on Warner Archive Instant, by the way, not to keep calling stuff out. But
no, that's good. No, call it out. If you know where it's at, then
Yakuza is on Warner.
Yeah. Keep calling stuff out. What else did you have in your notes, Eric?
That's pretty much it.
So a couple of the things I had in my, I have notes, and then I have my joke notes, which is funny stuff that I noticed. Another thing, so the grope thing was really funny. I can't stop laughing about that. And then the other one is how I keep forgetting your name. What's
Susan
her name?
George.
Susan George. Oh my God, third time. Susan George is with Franco Nero's best friend. You know, from I guess they fought. I think they mentioned the Congo.
It was Congo or Angola where they were mercenaries.
Yeah, yeah, they have that flashback.
Yeah, and so she's with his best friend, and all of a sudden one night she's like, ah, fuck it, I'm gonna sleep with Frank Nero, and just randomly goes to his bedroom, and Frank Nero's like, fuck it, and he just turns off the light.
Yeah, that was kind of bizarre. That sort of
right. I found that really weird. And then another one is so. His friend, you know, he loses all his workers and in his farm, you know.
Yeah.
And then they come back, and he's like, oh, here's like Peter, and here's this person, and then he's like, oh my God, you brought the cocks, cockfight.
And they
break into like just this crazy party where they're like just have a cockfight, and I found that really really interesting. Like I'm like, well. I guess PETA wasn't around back then, huh? And it wasn't filmed here. It was filmed, I think it was filmed, most of it was filmed in the Philippines. And then I think a couple of like exteriors in Japan from what now, I gathered.
Have you seen Machete Maidens Unleashed, the documentary that the guy that made Not Quite Hollywood made?
Yeah.
So Not Quite Hollywood is the Australian film.
Yes,
he made an Australian documentary. One.
Yeah.
Machete Maidens Unleashed is about the film industry in the Philippines in the 80s. And then his next project, which apparently is on hold now, is he was making a documentary about Canon.
Oh, we were just talking about that before. So it's on hold. What have you heard about that specifically?
The last thing I heard is it's on hold because he's remaking Patrick.
Interesting. I'd much rather see the documentary.
Me too.
I mean, I like Australian films and I like Patrick. I think it's an interesting film, but get me the Canon film documentary. God damn it.
I know.
So the whole thing about the Philippines was that Marcos was very open to filmmakers coming in and lent them the military and, you know, there was no safety guidelines and all that stuff. And that's why a lot of these films were made there in the 80s.
Oh, there you go. Well, that explains.
Yeah, if you haven't seen Machete Maidens Unleashed, I highly recommend it.
I haven't seen that one. I've seen the other one.
It's good. I mean, it's like that and then obviously American Grindhouse.
Yeah.
That whole group is a good group of docs.
Yeah. And and I like throughout the score is in general really good, but at parts it gets a little porno-y, a little like you're like, whoa, like okay, and not in like sex scenes. It just randomly like he'll be like walking at the market and it's like gets a little like a porno score. I was like, all right, did they get the guy from Taboo on this thing? So Enter the Dragon, Enter the Ninja. What would you grade this, Brian?
It's another 2.5 for me. Some good stuff, some boring stuff, but a lot of the cast really propels it enough. Sometimes that's enough for me to be interested, you know? But again, Apple first, then probably this, then New Year's Evil, as far as what priority.
All right. And Eric?
I actually am going to give it a 2. Like I said, I found it kind of a slog. I really like the opening and a lot of the stuff that Brian mentioned. I think it's definitely worth a watch. It's definitely worth watching with a group. But I would watch The Apple first, and then for me, maybe New Year's Evil second, and then this.
Yeah. For me, definitely a 2.5. I'm always close to a 3 on this one. It's just... It's Ninja Factor.
Yeah.
But I'd say if I were recommending somebody, I would go Enter the Ninja, The Apple, New Year's Evil. Just because this one's so, like... just fun. There's people dying.
You want to get them the fever.
Decapitation, cockfights.
That was really odd and random. That stuff, yeah. And he's so everybody's so excited. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they're like, yeah. And he's all, gather around in a circle.
Yeah, like we have, at my work, we have, you know, Bagel Friday, you know, they have cockfight, you know, Tuesday.
Casual cockfight Tuesdays.
Yes. So.
I, you know, that's, I like that. I'm going to try to implement that where I work.
There you go. Just bring them into the office.
Casual Tuesday cockfights.
There you go.
We won't get them. The thing about the cockfight is that they didn't have those like metal prongs in their claws, you know? So it's like they're lightly batting themselves around. No. All right. So yeah. So I'd give it 2.5. Two and a half. So. All right. Let's take another break and then we'll come back with our final film. All right, our final film in this episode, this is only part one. We have many films to cover in the future. Will be Death Wish Part 2, Part Dukes. And if you haven't seen the Charles Bronson series of Death Wish, you're missing out because there's a lot of killing. All right, so Death Wish 1, a little recap before Eric gives us a synopsis for Death Wish 2. Death Wish 1 is in New York. It takes place in New York. Charles Bronson plays an architect. He plays a character named
Paul Kersey.
And he's an architect. And he's got a wife and he has a daughter. And New York, it's not good, you know? And you have a group of eclectic gang that has a bunch of members. But one of them is Jeff Goldblum. And he's up to no good. He's not looking for his mantra. He's looking to rape and kill.
Yes.
And he breaks into Paul's house and he kills his wife and brutally rapes his daughter. So, you know, not a G-rated movie, all right? And so the cops really, you know, they don't do anything. So he takes it up to, you know, he takes the law into his own hands and he goes out and he becomes a vigilante. He's kind of like Batman without the costume, but he has no rules. He just kills. So he ends up killing the whole gang. The one of the detectives finds out by the end of the film that he's a vigilante, but he kind of looks the other way. He's like, you know what? You had to do it. You had your reasons, and you know, we had our hands tied. So he basically tells him, "I'm not going to arrest you, but you have to leave the city." And I think in Death Wish 1, correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't he say he's going to Chicago?
He does. It's Chicago or Kansas City, one of the two. Somewhere in the Midwest.
Yeah.
Jumping ahead to Death Wish 3, there's a mention of Chicago and I believe Kansas City as well as Los Angeles.
All right. So part 2 does not take place in Chicago. It takes place in L.A. So why don't you take it away, Eric?
Okay. So it is 8-9 years later. Bronson has moved to Los Angeles and basically started his life over. His daughter is in a mental institution of some kind, but she's definitely getting better. And he's got a new woman in his life. His job's going well. And they go out with his daughter for ice cream and run into a group of thugs, and things go bad from there.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
And, yeah. I mean, these thugs are. Go ahead. Sorry.
No. You go ahead.
Well, I was just gonna say, you know, he can't really catch a break. You know?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
He's like, you know, flypaper for thugs. They just like because he really there's like a whole line of people getting ice cream, and for some reason they decide to harass him, and I can't even remember why they do so. But you know, not only are they harassing him, but they're In the first Death Wish, the Jeff Goldblum and his gang sees the address that his wife and daughter are delivering their groceries to. Mm-hmm. In this case, I think they steal his wallet and look at his driver's license, get his address, go to his house, and fucking wait for him. In the meantime, raping his housekeeper. Pretty brutally, actually.
Yeah.
But so they're really proactive. You know, we're and vengeful.
I know, like these guys aren't like, you know, like carjacking people. These guys are like They're vengeful. And yeah, they pickpocket him. That's what it is. That's they what, pickpocket right. him, yep. and that's how they get his address.
Yeah, but I love that they pickpocket him, and he gives them some kind of shit about it, like you would.
Yeah.
I think he punches one of them because they stole his stuff, and they're like, well, we're going to fuck
you.
You should let us steal your shit and not make a peep about it, so we're going to go. But yeah, this definitely sets the tone for the Canon Films Death Wish films.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a much darker, grittier, more evil, exploitative environment, you know?
Yeah.
Well, the first film is about the urban decay of New York in the 1970s. This one is about the terror of L.A. in the 80s with the coming crack wars. And, I mean, not that these guys are Crips or Bloods. I mean, they're kind of the Hollywood, you know, been to the dance studio kind of gang.
Yeah.
You know, they're interracial and, you know, you got Lawrence Fishburne.
I was going to say, they have a Larry Fishburne in them.
Yeah, you know, and, you know, they're kind of new wavy and they don't, you know, they're dressed a little bit preppy. So, I mean, it's kind of that break between that gritty 70s and that kind of glossy 80s.
Yeah, I feel like the costume designer in like all the 80s movies, when they were dressing up the villains, like, it had to be a really flamboyant gay guy. It had to be. Because all these guys have, like, really crazy, like, shades, like sunglasses. Like, they kind of look like LeVar Burton. And, like, and, like, their clothes kind of look like what they think the future is going to look like. Like, how thugs are going to look like in 5 years. That's how everyone's wearing, like, weird, like, accessories. Like, neon is big for them. So,
Yeah, but at the same time, there's this interesting kind of throwback to the 60s counterculture past with kind of these hippie-ish, you know, flop houses and abandoned buildings that people are living in and these, you know, residence hotels that are like the bottom rung. So you kind of get a look at some of the end of that 70s kind of period just coming into that 80s.
Yeah. Well, you cut off there, so.
Okay. I was saying at the end of the 70s, you had the end of the crash pads and the
– Yeah.
It really, the drug gang culture from the 70s was very much focused on heroin. And in the 80s, of course, it was cocaine and crack. Yeah. And this is kind of the intersection of those two.
No, yeah. And definitely like what Brian was saying, like this definitely set the tone of – see, the thing is with Death Wish 1, I love Death Wish 1. Like
it's a legitimately good movie.
Yeah,
see, Death Wish 2 is, and I like Death Wish 2 also, but it's like prestige, Paramount, the period that Paramount was making films. Mm-hmm. It's post Godfather, but it's still they're very much in a prestige mode. It's based on an acclaimed novel, and it feels more literary. It takes its time more. This, I mean, since it's a sequel, it doesn't have to, and it definitely doesn't.
Yeah.
It's just a little sloppier. You
it's also a little slicker though in its look.
Yeah, no, that's fair. But I mean, it's just, it's definitely a different kind. You can tell that there's two different studios.
Yeah.
And two different time periods, obviously.
Definitely.
Yeah. And, in my research, apparently, Golan bought the rights to the series from Dino De Laurentiis for like $200,000.
Wow.
Yeah. And he got a lot out of it because, I mean, he made five films. Part one, two, and three, directed by the same director, Michael Winner. And then the last two had two different directors. So I'm not sure which directors they were, but yeah. So one, two, and three directed by the same director. And this one definitely just like you take a look at the first one and like because there's a rape in that. And it's mild, I mean, for its time. But you watch this one, there's two like rapes and they're hard to watch.
And they're brutal.
We're not even necessarily. I've seen the unrated or the X-rated version of this movie, and the rape scenes are even longer and just nearly intolerable, nearly unwatchable because they just stop the movie. I mean, it's one thing to make something exploitative, but to stop the movie, I don't know. I don't recommend seeking out the non-R-rated cut of this film because it's just not. It's unnecessary. You know what I'm saying?
As we were saying earlier, a good editor.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
And the R-rated cut, I think, you know, is certainly one of the better edited of the four films we've covered. But I think it gets even better editing wise in 3. I don't know. Maybe I just love that movie. I don't know what it is.
But. No, totally.
But the other thing that's interesting is right away, you get a sense of in both films, like the look and like we talked about, and the scores are the films are very different. There's almost like a jazzy score for the first one. It's much more. I don't know. I don't want to say graceful, but this one's by Jimmy Page, who I guess was Michael Winner's neighbor, who had been out of work for some time, and he agreed to do the score, and they end up reusing he has this fantastic sting that's just sort of like boom kind of thing. It's just really menacing, and it just sets the tone perfectly. Mm-hmm. And I first heard it in Death Wish 3, so I was associated with that. But I guess he originally wrote it for this film, and they just repurposed it for 3. But that's another part of the film that just sort of establishes it. It's a really he's doing some interesting stuff with growling guitars, and it's not like amazing musical work by Jimmy Page, but it's still an interesting component of the film, I think.
Yeah, and I think they use that stinger on like all of them. I think. I think 3 for sure, but I don't know. I want to say I even heard it in 5.
They could have brought it all.
Could have been a knockoff.
I remember first time I heard it was in 3.
Yeah,
and I will never. Like I said, I made a ringtone out of it and it's text tone. I just think it's such a great sound. You know.
I think he also did the score for 3, 2 and 3.
I think he did, but I think they repurposed a good portion of.
Yeah.
I gotta look that up, but
yeah. And then that was another thing that I was looking at. Oh, so from the first one to this one, it was 8 years. It took 8 years for them to make the sequel. And, I don't know if it was 8 years in the story, but, you could definitely tell he's a lot older. I think he was already in his 70s by the time this one came out.
I don't think you mean, the other book. I don't know that there's another book.
No, the first film. Sorry.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From the first one to the second one, it was 8 years. And I think by the time they finished the fifth one, he was in his late 70s.
Yeah. I mean, he got a late start.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, he was in obviously some films when he was younger, but as far as this period of his career, it came on late.
And yeah.
It's pretty impressive the amount of films that he did at the age that he was.
Yeah.
Because I used to love him.
And all of them were like action thrillers.
Very, very physical, and he's great.
Yeah.
But I was going to say, I read a note about the screenwriter approaching Bronson, basically this guy, I don't know what connection he had to Golan or Globus, but he had written this screenplay for 2, and he basically went up and knocked on Bronson's door and, you know, said, here's the script, and Bronson was like very shocked and surprised, and somehow, maybe they connected with Golan Globus, I forget, but he wasn't initially going to do it, but then they offered him supposedly like $1 million to take the role, and supposedly the budget of the film is only $2 million. Yeah. Or maybe it was $1.5 million. You know what, I think he got $1.5 million for this. So that only leaves like $500,000 for the production of the film, $1.5 million for Bronson. The movie netted something like $45 million.
Yeah.
So it did pretty well, but...
Yeah.
And this movie also stars Charles Bronson's wife in real life, Jill Ireland, which she only starred in this one, and then she never came back for the other ones.
Well, that was another thing in this film is that he's, you know, like I said, he's rebuilding his life. He's got this woman, and his choices affect what happened to them.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, very much. I mean, in the first film, his wife is murdered. You know, and in this one, you know, his love interest survives, but it's his actions that determine whether or not he's going to be by himself going on.
Yes. No, totally agree. And also, I think Vincent Gardenia was the only guy who came back for this one.
Yep.
I mean,
he was and he played one. The cop.
Yeah, he played the detective, Frank Ochoa. I like that guy.
I like him too. I think I first saw him in the first Death Wish movie. And
yeah.
Yeah.
He proliferates a lot of films in the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Any other notes you have on there, Eric?
Well, let me take a look here. You know, it's the 80s. It's L.A.
Yeah, another L.A. film. I actually like this better than New Year's Evil as far as the way that it depicts L.A. and parts of L.A. you get to see. Like, you get to see the Chinese theater at one point and some other stuff.
I think where he gets pickpocketed, I think that's on Olvera Street, I think.
Nice.
Yeah.
There's definitely some class divide kind of stuff going on here with, you know, he's wealthy and well off. I mean, maybe not like ultra rich, but, you know, he's got a comfortable life.
Yeah.
And he's interacting with these, you know, street people when he goes downtown. So there's that. I noticed the punk is dead spray paint in one scene. there's the use of an early taser by the cops.
Oh,
by the way, these are like the lamest LAPD cops I've seen on film in I don't know how long.
Yeah.
I mean, they're kind of middling effective.
Yeah. They tase the last guy, right? They
put him
like
so.
Yeah. That's a really funny scene because he's like on PCP and they can't get him down.
Yeah.
But yeah, what it's funny the just like listening to the villains' names, they have some pretty funny names like Stomper or Jiver.
Like, yeah.
Who else did you have?
Let's see. Just there's a religious undertone to it because there's a couple scenes where he's outside of a like storefront church listening, and I believe he talks to the priest at one point.
Yeah.
Well, and the best, my favorite. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was gonna say my favorite line in the movie is "You believe in Jesus, you're gonna meet him." But he says to that punk who looks, I forget that guy. He looks a little. He reminds me of the Alex Winter character in Death Wish 3, but I've seen that guy in some other stuff. The guy he shoots.
Well, there's definitely some Hollywood new waivers and punks in this.
Yeah.
And like you said, you know, there's a lot of lost L.A., you know, cityscape that pops up in this film.
Yeah.
And you know, and the politicians are all about covering their ass. It's very clear that it's not about getting things done. It's about covering their ass.
Yeah.
Eric, what was that documentary you sent me? It's on YouTube, and I think they're having trouble with the licensing of all the clips, but it's a really good documentary.
Oh, Los Angeles Plays Itself.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, it's great.
It's on YouTube. You could watch it.
I don't think it's ever going to come out officially.
Yeah, because of the licensing of the clips, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a really good documentary. It's long, but it's fun.
No, it's really neat.
It's good.
It is. It's worth checking out for sure.
Yeah. You were talking about abandoned buildings and things before. I missed that about... you know, you don't see that in movies now because it's not particularly realistic. I don't think. I don't feel like. I'm sure there are abandoned buildings, but it just feels like you don't see that in movies. And there's something really interesting and menacing about abandoned buildings in a cityscape. And especially
they have like hotels and stuff, which you know, once upon a time, you think about hotels being full and full of life and people coming in and out. And when you see them empty, there's just you know, you get that kind of shining vibe to them.
Yeah, yeah, that decay. Yeah, there's something. Agreed. Yeah,
yeah.
We should talk real briefly about that. The last hospital scene in the film is pretty great. Features a cameo by Chuck Cyphers, who I love.
Yeah.
Carpenter regular, and just has some ridiculous, crazy shit with some electroshock and stuff like that. But a lot of fun.
It definitely starts to go from the kind of dead serious social commentary of the original Death Wish to the kind of the high comedy or cartooniness of some of the later ones.
Yeah. I mean, that scene is aptly at the end of this film, nearly pretty straightforwardly setting up the transition into Death Wish 3, which is just a silly, crazy, awesome movie.
Yeah.
I watching this movie, I was reminded of that Simpsons joke where they're trying to go to Branson and they end up in Bronsonville. And everyone looks like Charles Bronson.
I don't remember.
And the baby's like, "Oh, I wish I was dead." And that's all I can think about when watching this movie was Bronsonville.
Well, didn't they? What was the "Oi, I wish I was dead" comes from what? A commercial for Death Wish 9 or something?
Yes.
I always remember that.
Yes.
That's one of my favorite jokes in all the Simpsons.
Yeah. This movie, definitely the end, and you have that same kind of. The character going, I know what you did, but I agree with it. I agree with you killing these guys. So the first one was a detective, and the second one was the hospital.
There's always some sort of vigilante enablers.
Yeah, he's like Charles Bronson's like, they killed and raped my daughter, you know? And he's like, I know.
Okay.
I recognize you. He's like, he's like, I'm going to give you 3 minutes before I hit the alarm. And Charles Fox is like, seriously? All right. And he like starts booking it.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely the beginning of this movie still was kind of like had a serious tone, the beginning of it, a little bit. But then like you guys, you start getting into like the weird fucking rape. And then you, by the time you get to the end, you're like, all right, they're setting up what will be Death Wish 3, 4, and 5.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
and you got to wonder if the kind of more cartoony tone was a move to make it more palatable to the masses, to make it more commercial.
Yeah.
You know, and to oversee sales or, you know, oh, yeah, it's going to be really violent and gory, but, you know, this might be a little more family friendly.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is weird because there's some gory, really gory scenes in this. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and then also, just like doing research on like on Golan, how he would go to these international markets and go, hey, you guys want this new Charles Bronson movie? Well, you'll also have to get this Cassavetes movie. You know what I mean? So he kind of is responsible, and I'm listening to interviews, like how he really kind of is responsible for bringing independent cinema to a lot of those countries, like, you know, like Thailand and the Philippines. Like a lot of those people eventually started watching those movies and saying, oh, these movies are really good. Cassavetes is awesome. Give us some more Cassavetes.
So you can have 10 to midnight, but you got to watch those streams too.
Yeah. Yeah. That's cool. Yeah, that was his kind of his plan to sell independent films with the, you know, the big, the movies with the big names.
Probably taking a cue from Roger Corman and AIP and stuff like that.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah. So they're doing some good stuff. I mean, I really like these guys, what they were doing, and, you know, fun movies. And also, little Death Wish trivia. I know Death Wish 1 was based on a novel.
Yeah.
And then I think they licensed the same novel to make, James Wan did, to make Death Sentence with Kevin Bacon.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which I still haven't seen.
Which I never saw it either. But from the trailer, I was like, this looks like a horrible version of Death Wish.
I heard okay things about it, actually. But.
And so I never saw it, but I did. Eventually, doing the research, I found out that they actually licensed the book. So, and just recently, I think a couple months ago, Joe Carnahan was still on. He was making a Death Wish remake.
Nice.
With oh my gosh, the guy from The Gray, actor
Liam Neeson.
No.
Oh.
He's in The Gray.
I've already seen that.
Oh my god,
are we talking about Dylan McDermott?
No, I'm sorry. He's a character actor. He's in that. He's on like End of Watch. He plays their lieutenant, Frank Grillo.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah, and the studio said Frank Grillo is not a big enough name. Yeah. And then he goes off and does, he's a new villain in the new Captain America.
Oh, is he? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm like, well, he's big enough where they want him as a villain, but apparently you don't want to make your Death Wish movie, which I would have loved, because,
well, it could still happen, right?
Maybe. It could. I mean,
you know, how much money do you really need to make a Death Wish film? I mean, you're not gonna have, like, you know, Star Wars style space battles or CGI. So this would be perfect for like an HBO movie or something that.
And to be honest, I've always said this, and it's funny that he cast him in it, because I've always said Frank Grillo has like a weird Charles Bronson feel to him. Mm-hmm. Like, Charles Bronson is one of the, like, I don't want to say the last, but you had those actors that were like a man's man. You know what I mean? Like Steve McQueen, Charles Bronson, you know,
Lee Marvin, Warren Oates.
Lee Marvin. Like, you watch interviews with Lee Marvin and you're like, man, this guy, he's like smoking in interviews, and it just, they're tough guys. They're like men, you know?
Well, they were both Marines, as I recall.
Yeah.
During World War II. So, I mean, they saw some stuff. They weren't just pretending. They lived it. I mean,
yeah. And that may be part of what we're missing, is some kind of life experience that leads them to be who they were.
Yeah, and I we don't have those type of leading men anymore. I feel like you watch George Clooney and like, you're like, yeah, he's a good leading man, but he doesn't have that, like, it's kind of what I've been watching a lot of Michael Mann because we're doing an episode on his films, but watching some of his films and like the commentary and stuff, like when you watch like Heat and you watch like some of the characters, he puts them through a certain training, so they have that in the background. You know, they have that, oh, well, I've shot a gun with live rounds. I know what that feels like.
All right, you're breaking up now.
So I was saying how you don't have that with the new leading man nowadays, where it's, you know, you're missing that. You're missing that, like, that bravado that, that you really don't need to show it or anything, but like Lee, like you said, Lee Marvin was, you know, he was, he saw some shit. So he had that to kind of back up.
Well, even somebody like Walter Matthau or Charles Durning, those guys served during the war as well. And
yeah,
I mean, yeah, it's, you're right. It's not there. And I think it, a lot of it has to do with a lot of the changes in our society and, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. But definitely Charles Bronson is the guy who had it. Like, you know, he wasn't playing a tough guy. He looks like if you eyeballed him in a bar, he'd beat the shit out of you.
Yeah.
So, all right. So what would you rate this, Brian?
This is a 3 out of 5 for me. Almost a 3.5.
Yeah.
But the next two get into higher grades for me.
Eric?
I'm going to give it 2.5. I enjoyed it. I think it felt a little slow to me in spots and not necessarily in a good way, but overall, it's definitely worth watching as part of the series. And it's talked about, you see that kind of transition between the first film and the later films. And, you know, you could see parts of LA that are no longer there, or at least a world that's no longer there.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I definitely would give it, I'd give it 3, same as Brian, just because, again, I love anything that's set in LA, just because, I don't know, I was born and raised here. So I definitely like just recognizing places and it's a good action movie. Yeah. I mean, for what it is, it's really good. I'd say this and 3 are on par for me. Like that, you know, I like them just as much. I don't give it a higher rating just because I love Death Wish 1 so much and it's so like gritty and stuff. So
yeah, Death Wish 1 is just a great movie. People should seek that out if they haven't seen it.
So I would go Death Wish for me. It would be Death Wish 2, Enter the Ninja, The Apple, and then New Year's Evil if you're gonna watch these. So, all right, I think that's it for that. For these four films, this is just part one of an ongoing series. We're going to be talking about the next four. I think next episode we're going to be doing, if you want to follow along and watch the films as we go along, I think we're going to do The Last American Virgin, That Championship Season, Treasure of the Four Crowns, 10 to Midnight, and probably Hercules with Lou Ferrigno. So,
okay.
I think those will be the next films we cover. I'll post it on Twitter if that changes, so you could follow along, guys. And here we go. You could follow us on Twitter at The Film Podcast. And you can go to our website that has a link to everything. Our Facebook, it's going to have a link to these guys, you know, their blogs, their Twitter, all that stuff. And you could find that at www.thefilmpodcast.com. Brian, where can people find you?
My blog is rupertpuptonspeaks.blogspot.com. I'm going to be starting an underrated drama series in a couple weeks. But go back and look at the underrated comedies list because there's about 3 months worth of stuff. Also, I've started reviewing a bunch of discs too, so you might be interested in those too. But I'm Bob Freelander on Twitter.
Yeah, at Bob Freelander. And then, Eric, where can people find you?
My blog is restlesskind.blogspot.com. And then I'm on Twitter as IrenZero. That's IrenZero. And, of course, on Facebook on the pages for Love That Album, podcast. I'm often on posting on the film podcast page along with the List Music podcast page.
Yeah. And then you could find me on Twitter at Ricardo, ULTRERES. That's a weird last name. I know. All right. And then a last thing, if you're going to buy something off Amazon, just come over to my, if you're going to buy, you know, go for, this is what I suggest. Go over to Brian's blog, check out his disc reviews. If you see something you like Ninja 3, which you will like, go over to our website. Click on our little Amazon link and buy it through Amazon, and you know Amazon will kick us over a few shekels. You know, speaking of Golan, they'll give us some shekels, and you know it doesn't cost you a thing, and it helps the podcast. So, all right, I want to thank both Brian and Eric for contributing, and it was really fun, and I can't wait to get into. I feel like these were the slow films, and once we get into I think we're it's just going to get better because of the films that we're going to be talking about. So thanks again for joining me, guys, and until next time, have a good week.